ice, goes to the abandoned city of Pripyat to hunt down the leader of the Russian ultranationalists. Stuart and his team decided to see the place for themselves. Vita, our animated young Ukrainian guide, first takes us to the 30-kilometer exclusion zone, and then to the more restricted 10-kilometer one. Two circles, one inside the other, with the former nuclear power plant at their center, and a radius of 30 kilometers, 18.6 miles, and 10 kilometers, 6.2 miles, respectively. We get to see the Soviet radar called Duga, or Arch, a response to Ronald Reagan's Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative, by today's standards, a low-tech system. It was designed to detect a possible nuclear attack from the east coast of the United States. From there, we proceeded to the city of Chernobyl, its nuclear power station, and the neighboring city of Pripyat, a ghost town that once housed close to 50,000 construction workers and operators of the destroyed plant. Vita gives us radiation counters that beep when levels exceed the established norm. In some areas, including those close to the damaged reactor, they beep non-stop. Vita then takes the decimeters away and shuts them off, just as Soviet workers sent to deal with the consequences of the disaster did back in 1986. They had to do their work, and the decimeters showed unacceptable levels of radiation. Vita has her own job to do. She tells us that in our whole day in the zone, we will get the same amount of radiation as an airplane passenger absorbs in an hour. We trust her assurance that the radiation levels are not too crazy. Altogether, 50 million curies of radiation were released by the Chernobyl explosion, the equivalent of 500 Hiroshima bombs. All that was required for such catastrophic fallout was the escape of less than 5% of the reactor's nuclear fuel. Originally, it had contained more than 250 pounds of enriched uranium, enough to pollute and devastate most of Europe. And if the other three reactors of the Chernobyl power plant had been damaged by the explosion of the first, then hardly any living and breathing organisms would have remained on the planet. For weeks after the accident, scientists and engineers did not know whether the explosion of the radioactive Chernobyl volcano would be followed by even deadlier ones. It was not, but the damage done by the first explosion will last for centuries. The half-life of the plutonium-239 that was released by the Chernobyl explosion and carried by winds all the way to Sweden is 24,000 years. Pripyat is sometimes referred to as the modern-day Pompeii. There are clear parallels between the two sites, but there are differences as well, if only because the Ukrainian city, its walls, ceilings, and even the occasional window pane, are still basically intact. It was not the heat or magma of a volcano that claimed and stopped life there, but invisible particles of radiation, which drove out the inhabitants but spared most of the vegetation, allowing wild animals to come back and claim the space once built and inhabited by humans. There are numerous marks of the long-gone communist past on the streets of the city. Communist-era slogans are still there, and inside the abandoned movie theatre, a portrait of a communist leader. Vita, our guide, says that no one can now tell who is depicted there. But I recognize a familiar face from my days as a young university professor in Ukraine at the time of the catastrophe. The painting is of Viktor Chebrikov, the head of the KGB from 1982 to 1988. It has miraculously survived the past 30 years, undamaged except for a tiny hole near Chebrikov's nose. Otherwise, the image is perfectly fine. We move on. It is strange, I think to myself, that Vita, an excellent tour guide, cannot identify Chebrikov. She also seems at a loss to explain the sign saying meat, milk, and cheese hanging from what was once the ceiling of an abandoned Soviet-era supermarket. How come, she asks, they write that in the Soviet Union